From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Sunnyvale, South Bay.
I live in Oakland, California.
Concord.
Parkside.
San Mateo.
I live in Alameda.
Marina.
Currently living in the Mission District.
Today, the Frisco Five are still on hunger strike. How are they doing and what's next?
Their bodies are weak, but the doctor has said that they are actually doing pretty well for people who haven't eaten for 14 days.
Then what the legacy of revolutionary Angela Davis means to her niece.
I just kind of grew up with this great sense of burden and this sense of inadequacy.
And how neighborhood change in Oakland will affect someone they call the Birdman and his birds.
I can't abandon them. You know, this is what means most to me.
Small and revolutionary changes today on Cross Currents. Yesterday afternoon, protesters marched to San Francisco City Hall demanding an end to police brutality and rampant racial bias. They were led by the Frisco Five hunger strikers, a grandmother, two rappers, an educator, and a supervisor candidate. They refused to eat in protest of excessive use of force by SFPD, resulting in the deaths of Mario Woods, Alex Nieto, Amilcar Lopez, and Luis Gongora, all men of color. Yaine Abebe is the spokesperson for the group. She came by our studios and talked to KALW's Ben Trefney.
So how is the current health of the hunger strikers?
Their bodies are weak. They can be unfocused at times, but the doctor has said that they are actually doing pretty well for people who haven't eaten for 14 days.
And are they taking in liquids?
They are drinking coconut water, electrolyte waters. Woman who owns a juice bar called Raw in Upper Haight, who's been making fresh pressed juices for them in the morning, and we've been bringing them broth.
For you and other people supporting the Frisco Five, how do you think the demonstration is going so far?
I thought that we were making progress. These are my friends, so it's hard for me. Yesterday, after the rally, it kind of hit me, and I don't cry a lot, and I've been crying a lot. Crying out of joy to see over 1,000 people come and support them and march with us to City Hall, and crying in disappointment at how City Hall has reacted to the demands of the people.
Well, what conversations have you been able to have with elected officials so far?
Well, the five, I held space outside with the community that came to support us yesterday, and they went to meet with the mayor, and the mayor was not there. And I think he did that on purpose. He's been incredibly disrespectful to the community of color. And the Board of Supervisors just acted like, well, we don't have any real power. There's nothing we can do. And so it's been incredibly disrespectful. City Hall's been incredibly disrespectful.
So that said, on Monday, Mayor Lee went to the Mission Police Department mm-hmm. with Paul Henderson, who's mm-hmm. his Deputy Chief of Staff and Director of Public Safety for the city, and with Joe Marshall, who has run the Omega Boys Club. And both of those guys are from Bayview. Both of them are black men. And Mayor Lee sat there with those men and waited for half an hour to talk with the Frisco Five. And they decided not to go talk with him. So why was that?
It's because he demanded a meeting unannounced, and he did not want the press there. He did not want other members of the community there. And he tried to initiate the meeting with Christina Gutierrez. She is one of the Frisco Five, and uh-huh. she's the mother of Equipto, who's also part of the Frisco Five. So she's the now great-grandma who orchestrated this strike. He wanted to meet with just her, and she said, no, I will only meet if it's the five of us together and the press and the community. He refused. So I think that was a big PR stunt on his part. He tried to make it seem like, well, I tried to communicate with them and they refused and they're getting political. Well, he's a politician. You know what I mean? He's the mayor of San Francisco and the people elected him. And he's saying it had to be on my terms. And if they're not going to do it on my terms, then I'm not going to meet with them.
How is that more of a PR event than a public hunger strike and march to City Hall?
A public hunger strike and march to City Hall, it was necessary because he was ignoring the fact that black and brown people are being killed in San Francisco.
But he went with saying he went with black representatives.
Those are black representatives who represent City Hall. They do not represent the community.
Well, Joe Marshall is a police commissioner.
Joe Marshall is a police commissioner who is sided with the police department and not with the people.
Mm-hmm. So it's just confusing to me that if you had an audience with the mayor, whether it was public, private, whatever, to talk about the concerns that you have. Why not take advantage of that? He's very hard to get a hold of.
But he refused to meet with all five. He refused to allow other members of the community to be part of it, and he refused to allow the press to be part of it.
Well, they have said that they are not firing Chief Sir, and the Frisco Five have said that they're going to conduct a hunger strike until Chief Sir is fired. So that sounds like an impasse, and there's no conversation going on. So how does this end?
I'm not sure how it ends. If the community would step up and put pressure on City Hall, it would probably end sooner. But them saying, we're not going to do it, even though you're putting your life on the line, shows how much value they have for Black and brown lives in San Francisco.
That was Yaine Abebe talking to KALW's Ben Trefney. You can hear more about the Frisco Five on today's episode of Your Call with Rose Aguilar. It's online at KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. The name Angela Davis is synonymous with revolution, but her niece, Issa Davis, didn't learn that until later in life.
I did know that my aunt was a public figure of some kind, and I did know that my mom had done everything she could to save her sister's life.
Angela Davis joined the civil rights movement in 1963. She was shocked by the deaths of four little girls killed in the Birmingham church bombing. After years fighting against oppression, Davis became a member of the Black Panther Party. She was accused of participating in a prisoner escape plan at a Marin County courthouse, which resulted in several deaths. She fled, was arrested, and later acquitted. Her family stood strong behind her, leading the Free Angela Davis campaign. Today, we continue our series, The Families of Revolutionaries. We talk to actress, playwright, singer, and proud niece, Issa Davis.
So are you quite close to your aunt, Angela Davis?
Yeah, she is really one of my parents. I have always considered her to be that because my mom raised me in the same town as Angela. And for some of that time, my mom was a single mom and they're very close. So I really consider myself both of their children, or the child of both of them, I should say. But yeah, I just always spent a lot of time with her growing up in Oakland. And, you know, that just meant like coming over and borrowing a vacuum cleaner, or playing with her dogs, or going running, or going to dance class. Sometimes she would help me with some writing that I was doing. I wrote my college applications in her kitchen. And we've just really stayed close over all these years.
And you grew up in Oakland, right? What was that like?
Yeah, I grew up in Oakland, North Oakland. And Berkeley, spent a lot of time in Berkeley going to school. And that's, in some ways, another huge part of my upbringing is growing up in this hotbed of progressive politics, of liberatory thinking, of counterculture.
And your family went through a lot, especially the years that your aunt, Angela Davis, was incarcerated. What was it like for you as a child being surrounded by this major international event?
When Angela was in jail, my mom was spearheading the campaign to free her. And so when I was 2 months old, she left me with my grandmother in Birmingham, and she traveled all around the world campaigning for Angela's freedom. So that's another reason why I spent a lot of time with my grandmother, is that my mom was pretty busy.
So you were quite young when that campaign was happening to free your aunt. What were the conversations like at home? What do you remember?
There really weren't many around that at all. Like I said, I was born when she was in jail, and I was one when she was acquitted. So I don't recall anything directly. It's less that I knew stories and more that this was just a way of life, that activism is what you do because our lives depend upon it.
Then it wasn't until you were much older that you began to understand your aunt's story?
I feel like I really didn't understand where she fit in the world and what her place was alongside all of the other figures that we know the names of until I got to college, I think. And there I started really studying in earnest the history of African Americans, both here and throughout the diaspora, from a lot of angles. And that's when I think I really started to understand her significance. And I started being able to see her once I had left home. I started to be able to see her in the way that other people all over the world saw her. But when I was close up, that was not something that I really understood. So it was going away to college and having that space where I was starting to understand who she was as an independent being and where she stood next to all of the great leaders of the 20th century.
I'm speaking with Issa Davis, the niece of Angela Davis. So the world was just sort of rallying around her, or they were completely against her. Angela Davis was on the 10 most wanted list when you were growing up, right?
Yeah, she was on the 10 most wanted list. And so she's this victorious figure. And what, you know, I understood, I think, better than ever once I got to college, and I think I'm still understanding it more now, is that her strength really comes from the fact that she is the beneficiary of a huge mass movement, people who saw themselves in her and actually took up her cause. And that's the reason why she was acquitted, is that, you know, the judge understood that, you know, the whole world was asking for her freedom, demanding it, you know?
So as her niece, did you find it hard to find your path or your space in terms of what it meant to be in such a politicized family?
Basically, I'm kind of a different stripe. I'm like a different breed, even though I'm very much in their family. And so, you know, as a kid, I was less concerned with, you know, being an activist in the exact same way that they were. And I was interested in, you know, my friends and music and like having a boyfriend, you know, just all these things that seemed very petty compared to ending oppression in the world. And so I just kind of grew up with this great sense of burden and this sense of inadequacy, you know? I'm really excited that I get to make things that are able to affect the notions that people have about themselves and also about, for Black women, you know, that I get to shift how people see Black women through the roles that I play or the ones that I write, you know, or through the way that I sing.
And Issa, you have a really strong role in the Netflix series House of Cards. What does your aunt say about you in this role, in a show that's based on this very, very dark side of politics?
That's a good question. I don't know if she's seen me on House of Cards. I don't really talk too often about, or I guess I don't really promote my work as an actor too often to my family. And then they get mad at me because they're like, why didn't you tell us you were on this show? I don't know. I don't know if she's seen it. But, you know, when she's seen me on other shows on television, she's like, oh, I love seeing you on TV. Yeah.
Do people ever find out that you're Angela Davis's niece and are completely taken aback by it? I mean, does this come up for you in auditions or in the theater world?
That comes up all the time. You know, I'll give people my credit card. It says Angela Davis on it. And people are like, oh, that's a powerful name. Like, that's heavy, you know? And I'm like, yeah, you're right. but yeah, I mean, you know, it's just one of these things where I have no idea what kinds of assumptions people are making about me, if they know. But, you know, it's just... It's just my life, so I can't really do anything about it, and it's fine that I can't. You know, I'm just, like I said, just honored to be in the family.
Issa Davis continues to sing and perform theater in Brooklyn, where she lives now. Her Aunt Angela lectures around the globe and is a professor in the History of Consciousness and Feminist Studies departments at UC Santa Cruz. Tomorrow, you'll hear from the family member of another revolutionary.
I am evangelist Alveda King.
Maybe you can guess who Alveda is related to. And today we're going to honor one more revolutionary family member, Afeni Shakur, who died yesterday in Sausalito. She was the mother of Tupac Shakur, the iconic rapper, and an activist herself. She was also involved in the Black Panther Party.
There's no way I can pay you back, but the plan is to show you that I understand. You all appreciate it.
Afeni Shakur said about her son's murder, "You can kill a revolutionary, but you cannot kill a revolution." This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Just past Jack London Square in Oakland, there's a zone along the water that's a little wild. Past the new condos and restaurants, past the wholesale produce warehouses that open for business before dawn, and down the channel from the newly landscaped park at Lake Merritt, there are vacant lots around the water. It's an in-between space. If you walk across an old bridge over the Lake Merritt channel, you'll see tents, part of a long-standing homeless encampment, and you'll see geese, a bigger, more swan-like breed than the Canadian ones all around the lake. But change is coming to this spot. The estuary is being redesigned as a park, and over 3,000 new housing units are being planned for the land nearby. Next Wednesday, that old bridge over the channel will be closed down for reconstruction. Drivers will just take a detour route, but for the people who live there, it's the end of an era, especially for someone known as the Birdman. KALW's Liza Veal went to meet him.
I'm looking for somebody named Birdman.
Here's what I know about the person I'm about to meet. For 13 years, he's cared for a flock of up to 40 geese.
How do I get to that side?
You can't see Birdman's setup from the road. You can see the geese, though. Dozens of them eat grass by the water, and they come when he calls for them.
Thank you very much.
Birdman's given name is Tig.
Birdman.
He hasn't used his last name in decades.
Hi.
He's in his mid-50s, skinny, wearing a red bandana and a newsboy cap.
Can I get in this way?
He's sitting in a chair against an overpass, basically his front yard, overlooking the estuary.
Cool.
He made this a real home, with rugs, a new coat of paint, even a foundation.
Nice to meet you.
He's marked his area with chain-link fencing, decorated with little sculptures. And there's a second chair where I take a seat.
So how's it going?
I'm kind of traumatized, actually. I just killed a bird. Jesus Christ. I came here today and his beak was broken. But I never have... Jesus Christ.
So because his beak was broken, you felt like...
He can't eat.
Yeah.
I mean, there wasn't any reason to delay it, you know?
Birdman loves his birds. They are why he's still here after so many years.
What's going on, Baba? Hi, Gulliver. How you doing?
He can mimic their sounds, and they mimic him back. He feeds them and brings them fresh water every day. When he can't be here to do that, he asks someone else to.
They look exactly like toddlers with diapers.
I know. They look much more graceful in the water.
It took years for Birdman to get to know these geese so well. When he first showed up here 13 years ago, there were just a few. But that's not why he came.
It is mostly a tweaker culture.
People do a lot of speed at this encampment. That's what brought him. And back then, the geese...
Well, they were here and they were really obnoxious.
The people from the encampment fed them white bread at night.
And so they'd gotten in the habit with these people of coming in the middle of the night and setting up this gigantic shriek-a-thon, you know, with all of them.
Birdman wanted to break the geese's nighttime shrieking habit so that he could get sleep. He'd yell at the tweakers.
Yeah, and I was like, don't do it, you know, you'll never be free of it, right?
So instead, he'd feed the geese during the day, scavenged rice and produce. And then he noticed they had other problems, like how oil was constantly getting into the water, which the birds would lick off themselves.
They're being poisoned. So I started getting them water.
And he tried to clean the oil off of them.
I did silly things like chase them around with a spray bottle with diluted detergent in it, you know, and trying to spray them because I thought that might help them get it off quicker and stuff.
The birds grew accustomed to him, even returned his affection. Some of them will wrap their necks around his. He became their caretaker, so more and more of them survived. During nesting season, he couldn't bear to see the mothers lose their babies, so he'd defend the eggs from predators, like other birds and possums.
I used to throw rocks at them and, get out of here. I was crazy about it.
The birds gradually became his. And after a few years, his neighbors didn't call him Tige anymore. They called him the Birdman.
When you live with animals and you don't exploit them, it's a totally different relationship. I learned a whole bunch. They have tremendous love in them. You know, and they have tremendous love for humans because they have been around us, you know. And so somehow they're expecting us, they're, you know, they give themselves to us, you know. And it's kind of like, oh, shit, you know, when you realize that's actually a kind of love.
Except for a few relationships in his life, Birdman doesn't feel much affinity for humans or the built world. He wasn't forced to live outside. He comes from some money. In upstate New York, his dad was a doctor. Mom didn't work. Both drank a lot. And he was bullied by 6 older siblings. He says as a kid, when he couldn't take it, he'd head for the woods and camp out.
Yeah, because I didn't like society, right? I don't like our civilization, you know? I don't believe in it, if you will, right? And then I was kind of idealistic, you know, we should try to like live as if the world is the way you wanted it, right?
As an adult, he tried to do that with other people for a while. He came to the Bay Area and got into partying. He formed a co-op with some friends. They ran an underground techno venue.
It's a more of a wild and free and communal attempt at living.
But after 5 years, he wanted out of the party business.
But I just became disappointed with people's ability to sustain it beyond the party, you know.
So he left what he calls the ego circus and went to nature. He stayed in a hollowed out redwood tree for 2 years in Big Sur, living off the land. Eventually, he came back. He was lonely. But he found that his friendships were different.
All of a sudden, they don't really know if they can trust you in their house.
He had dropped out too far.
I underestimated the rift, you know. I underestimated it. It becomes sort of almost irrevocable decision. It's like, screw you, you know. I like to down out people better.
So he moved under the bridge. He became militant about scavenging his livelihood, surviving without money. And he got heavy into tweaking, trading things he found for drugs.
I mean, it was wonderful. The first couple of years, 5 years or so, 6 years I was here, because I had total freedom. And I'd be up all night playing drums. I played drums all night long, you know. And get up at dawn and go dumpstering on your bike, you know.
That's not his lifestyle anymore, though. He gave up the drugs a long time ago, and then 3 years ago he moved indoors, into a dormitory-style SRO he says is run by a slumlord. He's been walking 40 minutes here to feed the birds.
I mean, I've almost become suicidal about these guys, you know? I can't abandon them, you know? I've been here for 3 years, you know, thinking I should do something else, but I don't know. This is what means most to me.
But he'll have to abandon them. In a few days, this whole area will be a construction zone. He doesn't know how they'll survive it, but he knows there's not much that he can do about that anymore. After 13 years, they'll have to be on their own. Birdman feels a responsibility to the geese because he says when we domesticated them for food, we bred the migration instinct out of the bird. made it dependent on us.
It doesn't have its own nature anymore, you know? Its nature is to be used by somebody else, so it can't survive on its own, right?
But the birds and the birdman could survive here, scavenging off this bit of the city. But for both of them, being wild is no longer a choice. In Oakland, I'm Liza Veal for Cross Currents.
Thanks, Liza. Our reporters love going out and bringing you voices from folks around the Bay. So if there's someone you think we should talk to, well, tell us about them. Email us at news@kalw.org. And remember, you can hear more stories and voices if you check out our podcast. It's at kalw.org/subscribe. Our team includes Luisa Cardosa, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, Stephen Short, and Eli Wirtschafter. Today's show is engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Liza Veal. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.